Let's turn back to Romans chapter 1. Last hour, you'll recall, we looked at the declaration of God's wrath in Romans chapter 1:18. And now we'll start looking at the reason for God's wrath in verses 19 through 23. In this section, talking about the reason for God's wrath, will extend clear over to chapter 3 and verse 20. But for this morning, we'll be looking at 19 to 23. Let's start with verse 18 and read those verses. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Remember, in the outline of Romans, we're still in the very first section, what we could call the bad news section of Romans that goes from 1:1 to 3:20, that talks about God's wrath and why God's wrath is revealed against men. In verse 21 of chapter 3, we'll switch gears and talk about the revelation of God's salvation. So this first section talks about man's problem. The second section talks about God's solution to man's problem. And the third section in chapters 9 through 11 will talk about nation Israel. There's always going to be the question, well, what about Israel? Israel was God's channel of blessing in the Old Testament. How come now we get to the New Testament and Paul hasn't mentioned them? Well, he'll explain that in chapters 9 through 11. And then in chapters 12 through 16, we'll turn to a little more practical section, if you want to call it that. I think doctrine is very practical, but the section 12 through 16 deals with how we should react to that or respond to all the doctrine that we've learned in the first 11 chapters. So that's the overview of Romans. We're talking about man's need for salvation, 1:18 to 3:20. And we start out, as last hour, we'll give a little outline of this section. It's going to break it down into several subsections here. When talking about man's need for salvation, Paul is going to break it down into several categories. First, he'll talk about the sin of the pagan man. These are the people who don't have Bibles. These are the ones you hear asked about when you proclaim the gospel to somebody. A lot of people say, well, what about all those people in third world countries that have never heard the gospel? Well, this is going to talk about them. Verse 18 through 32 is going to show that even if they don't have the gospel message, they have revelation from God. And you know what they do with it? They reject revelation from God. So they have it, they reject it. So they're just as guilty before God. And that's the section we're talking about. And remember, this whole section deals with why everybody needs the righteousness of God. Verse 20, for example, says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." Now, when we get to chapter 2, Paul's going to switch gears and talk about the moral man. This isn't the one who takes a tree that God made so that we can know God and cuts down the tree and carves an idol out of it and worships the idol. This is going to be a moral person. This is going to be the person who says, I look down at those pagans. I'm moral. I do not sin against my fellow man. And Paul's going to say, you know what? You're just as bad off as they are. And we'll see as we go through these sections in talking about why everybody needs God's righteousness, we'll find that not everyone is equally bad. But you know what? Everyone is equally bad off because everybody's in the same boat. And that's going to be the whole thrust of this section. Everybody's in the same boat. No matter if you're a pagan, if you're a moral man, if you're a religious man, it doesn't matter. Everybody's in the same boat. The religious man is dealt with in 2:17 through 3:8. Look at 2:17, for example, where Paul says, "But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know His will, approve of the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law." These people have the Bible. They're Jews. They know the law. They've been instructed out of the law. You know what? They're still in the same boat with everybody else. So we can conclude in chapter 3, verse 9 through 20 makes this conclusion that everybody is under sin. Everybody is equally bad off. Now, you may not be as bad as the neighbor down the street who's a bank robber. But you know what? You're just as bad off as he is when it comes to salvation. So everybody is equally bad off. Chapter 3, verse 9. It says, "What then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one." So everybody is going to be in the same boat. And that's what this first section of Romans is doing. It's gathering everybody up, putting them in the same boat. And then Paul is going to turn to God's solution to that problem then. But first we need to know that we have a problem. Remember last time we saw that God's wrath was revealed. And we noticed that, you know what? Man doesn't even know that he's in the situation that he's in unless God tells him. So God reveals His attitude towards sin. In verse 18, He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." That's God's attitude towards sin. Wrath. And we looked at that word wrath in some detail. The word means anger. The strongest of all emotions. It's one that gathers up over time. Not an outburst of anger, but an anger that builds over time. So in verse 17 we saw the righteousness of God is revealed. Why do we need that? Why do I need God's righteousness? Well, because the wrath of God is revealed against unrighteousness. Well, who's unrighteous? That's this section. Everybody. And verse 19 now through 23 that we'll be looking at this morning is going to be the first thing that tells us what Paul means when he says that man suppresses the truth. Remember the word suppresses the truth that we saw in the last part of verse 18. Men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. That word means to hold down, to hold down in a bad sense. So man is going to see God's revelation. What's he going to do about it? Hold it down. He's going to ignore it as best he can, or to explain it away as best he can. And that's man's basic sin, is he takes God's revelation, truth, in whatever form it may be. Remember last week, we looked at two kinds of revelation. General revelation, that is creation. Everybody can see a tree, and we should be able to infer from creation not only that God exists, but who God is. Some things about Him, and we'll see that later this hour, that we'll see some things about God in creation, not simply that He exists. Okay, then, the reason for God's wrath in verses 19 through 23. The first one, in verse 19, Paul makes it very clear that man possesses revelation. Nobody is going to be able to stand before God and say, "I never knew." Everybody possesses revelation to some degree, not always to the same degree, but to some degree, everybody possesses revelation. Look at verse 19. It says, because that which is known about God, and the word known there is the word gnostos, and that always refers to real knowledge. It never refers to potential knowledge. It's always real knowledge. So verse 19 says, that which is known about God means that man possesses real knowledge about God. It's not something that man might know. It's something that man does know. It's real knowledge. So this verse is not talking about what is knowable about God. It's talking about what is actually known about God. Now notice, this verse starts with the word because, and that kind of keys us to this section. It says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Why is God's wrath revealed? Well, because that which is known about God is evident within them. So this is going to be an explanation of why God's wrath is revealed. And the first reason is because all man has revelation. Everybody. No exceptions. Notice it says, that which is known about God is evident within them. The word evident, phaneros, it means clear, plain, obvious. So it's known. It's not maybe known or can be known. It is known. Now this last part of verse 20 answers another question. Somebody is going to say, well, yeah, okay, I saw creation, but I didn't understand. I didn't know what it meant. Well, you know, I didn't get it. Well, verse 20 says, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. And how? Being understood through what has been made so that they are without excuse. So nobody can say, I didn't understand, because God's attributes are clearly seen. Now there's a question. Wait a minute. Verse 20, it says, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. How can you see something that's invisible? Well, that question is answered right in the context. It says, being understood through what has been made. So how can you clearly see God's invisible attributes? By observing what He made. Now we can use an illustration. I have never seen an atom. Never seen one. They're too little to see. They're invisible. But you know what? After World War II, I know atoms exist, because I can look in the history books and see pictures of cities that were blown completely off the face of the planet because of what atoms do. Now, I don't understand all of that stuff, but I can sure see the results. So I know there's such a thing as an atom. And being from Nebraska, we have in Nebraska the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant. And that works on atomic principles, atomic power. And you know what? When you flip the light switch on, the light comes on. What does that mean? Well, I know there's atoms then, because that's what gives the power for the light bulb. So I can know that atoms exist, even though I've never seen one. Why? Because I can observe the results. I can observe the effects of atoms. You know what? God's attributes are just like that. You can't see God's power. But you know what? If you look at creation, you should be able to know that God does have power. We have a powerful God because He made all of this. This has been true since the beginning of creation. You know what? The evidence has been here since the creation of the world. So every person who's ever lived has had an opportunity to know God's attributes. every person who's ever lived. It's interesting, you know, God made the earth before He made man. Everybody who's ever lived has had an opportunity to know God's attributes. No matter where he lives, no matter if he's heard the gospel or not, he can know that God is powerful just by looking at the universe. Now, this principle can be defeated. Revelation is understandable. It's very plain in the text. So what does man do? It's easy to defeat this. He takes God out of creation. He says God didn't make anything. What we see, the creation, has all come about through natural processes. And every process that we see happening now is what caused creation. There's nothing different. So if God isn't the creator, how can we learn anything about God from looking at creation? See what man does? He suppresses the truth. He holds it down. You know, man has truth. We have creation. And we can see that God is powerful by looking at creation. So what does man do? Oh, God didn't make anything. It all came about just by time and chance. You know, random mutations. The whole theory of organic evolutionism depends on the fact that there's no God. It depends on it because it's random mutations and natural selection. So they have taken God completely out of the loop in creation. Gee, what does verse 18 say? They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And that's pretty much blatantly ignoring God's truth. Now, notice that creation teaches us not only that God exists, and we kind of get that idea sometimes. We think, well, creation teaches me that God exists, yes. But it teaches more than that. Because of verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen." Now, eternal power is a specific attribute of God. God is power. You know what? The more we learn about the universe, and our science is wonderful. We can learn all kinds of things about the universe. And the more we learn, we should be more aware of God's power. You know, looking deeper and deeper into genes and chromosomes and things like that, the more we look at that, the more we should be aware of what a powerful God it took to create something that complex. And what does man do? The more he learns, the further he gets from God's truth. This is highly illogical and highly irrational. But you know what? Man holds down the truth in unrighteousness. He suppresses the truth. So we can learn not only that God is, but who God is by looking at creation. We have two terms here. His invisible attributes, His eternal power, and that's a very specific attribute of God, and divine nature. Now, divine nature is a little more generic term. That's a term that refers to the sum total of God's attributes. We can learn that, too, by looking at creation. Why is it understandable? Well, because it teaches very clearly. Creation teaches very clearly. Being understood in verse 20, it says that His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. How are they seen? Being understood through what has been made. Now, being understood is the word na'e'o. Na'e'o is the Greek word. And it's a verb form of the word nous. Nous is the word for mind in Greek. So it's very clearly seen. It's understood. We can understand it in our mind. Clearly seen, katharao, means unmistakable. So this revelation that we have in creation is understandable. Why is it understandable? Because it teaches very clearly. And it takes a really clever mind to ignore it. But man does. He ignores creation. He holds it down. He suppresses the truth. Not only is revelation clearly seen, or God's attributes clearly seen through revelation, that means that man is obligated by revelation. Man is surrounded by evidence, not only that there is a God, but who God is, His attributes. He's surrounded by that. He's surrounded by evidence that God is powerful. Therefore, man has no excuse. Last part of verse 20, it says, so that they are without excuse. So when somebody asks you the question, well, what about, and they'll say, what about the people in China? What about the people in the outback in Australia, the Aborigines? They've never heard the gospel. What about them? You know what? They have clear evidence not only that God exists, but who God is. Now, does that mean that they're saved if they believe that? It doesn't matter because they don't believe it. What do? They take all this evidence they have of not only that God is, but who God is, and they ignore it. They hold it down. They'll take the tree that God made to show them that He's powerful, and they'll cut it down and carve an image out of it and worship the image. So they're without excuse. Verse 21 tells us that man not only has revelation, he can not only understand revelation, because revelation is clear, but man has rejected revelation. Verse 21, it says, for even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. So, what sense does man know God here? It says, for even though they knew God. Well, it doesn't mean they know God in that they know the gospel message, but they know God in as much as they can see creation and know God from that. So they know what can be known of God through the revelation of creation. So they're without excuse because they reject that revelation. What does man do? He has real knowledge of God. He denies God's existence. He attacks His character. He questions His actions and His plans. One of the philosophers, and I forget which one, and I didn't take time to look it up, but one of the philosophers made the statement, if there is a God, He's the devil. And that all, what that means is he's looked around, and what does he see? He sees suffering. He sees pain. He sees death. And he said, you know, if God came up with this, He's the devil. Well, he questions God's plan. Now, he doesn't bother to stop and think that all of that came about through man's sin, not God's plan. So, what does man do? He has real knowledge of God. He can see it in creation. He denies God even exists. He attacks His character. He questions everything God does. He does not honor Him as God, it goes on to say. Did not honor Him as God. Honor Him as God simply means to respond properly to His attributes. What does that mean? Well, it's simple. God is truth, right? How should we respond to that attribute of God? We should believe Him. You know, that's very simple. It's an appropriate response to the attribute that God is truth, is that we should believe Him. Does man do that? No, he doesn't. He ignores God. He refuses to believe God in the face of all the evidence of creation. Man has rejected revelation. He does not give thanks. First, he doesn't honor God as God. He does not give thanks. Since God is the provider of everything we have, then, and you can see it in creation. Everything you eat, drink, you know, you build your house out of things that are created. Everything created supplies all our needs, and we don't bother to thank God for it. Now, that's just common courtesy. And, you know, I'll tell you a story. My daughter, when she was going to school up in Lincoln, she had an apartment. And if you know my daughter, you know she doesn't like to be alone a lot. So she didn't like to eat alone, so she bought a fish. And it was one of those male bettas, you know, a Siamese fighting fish. And she brought it with her when she moved down here. And you know what? When Ruth puts her hand over that fish bowl, the fish goes nuts. It goes up to the top and starts waiting for food. Even that fish knows who feeds it, who provides for it. You know, that fish has to have a brain the size of a, I don't know, that's got to, you know, the whole fish is only that big. But, and yet that fish knows who takes care of it. Now, as a tribute to my daughter, she kept that fish alive for a whole year. And if you know my daughter, you know that's a tribute to her. I'm going to get in trouble for this, I know. So, he does not give thanks. Now, man doesn't even have the common courtesy or the intelligence of a male betta fish to know who takes care of him. We have creation that's been provided for us to take care of us, and we don't even give thanks. Do we honor God as God? Do we respond properly to His attributes? No, we ignore Him. We say He doesn't exist. We hold down the truth. We don't even bother to thank Him for what we have. So, now when somebody asks you again, well, what about those people, you know, who never heard the gospel? You can say, look at Romans chapter 1. They're no different than the people who have heard the gospel. They're sinners. They ignore God. They hold down the truth in unrighteousness. So what's the result of that? Last part of verse 21, they become futile. Verse 21 says, they became futile in their speculations. Futile, mataiao, means empty in terms of success. So they've become empty in terms of success. That's the result of their holding down the truth, actually. They don't honor Him as God. They don't give thanks. What do? They become futile. Speculation is kind of a, I don't know, maybe an unfortunate translation. Dialogismos means it refers to the reasoning or the intellect. We think of speculation as just, oh, what might be, this kind of imagination type thing. But dialogismos refers to reasoning. It refers to the intellect. So man has become futile or empty in terms of success in the sphere of his reasoning, his intellect. Now, this word, dialogismos, is always used in a bad sense in the New Testament. It's the mind as used in opposition to God. So, God gives man creation. What does man do with his mind? Well, he uses it to create false gods that aren't really gods. That's the result. Their foolish heart was darkened. Now, heart is something we have to stop and look at too. Heart, we think of the heart as the seat of emotions in people. Because in our culture, that's what we talk about. You know, from the heart. Means from your emotions. Well, the Greeks didn't think of it this way at all. The heart had a much broader meaning to them. Heart, the word cardia, means the whole inner person. It's a very broad term. It refers to the emotions. It also refers to the intellect. And it also refers to the will. So when it says man's heart was darkened, it doesn't simply mean that man became an emotional cripple. It means that man is fallen in his very nature. His intellect is fallen, his will is fallen, and his feelings are fallen. So, man, having a fallen intellect, cannot as the philosophers say, reason outward from himself. Because our intellect is fallen. We can't just sit down under a tree, sip a Coke, and come up with God's plan of salvation. Doesn't work. Because man's intellect is fallen. We can't do that. That's what it means here when it says his foolish heart was darkened. So what does man do then? He's exchanged revelation. Not only has he rejected revelation, but he's exchanged it. What does he exchange it for? Well, two things. First, verse 22, he rejects God's revelation for human wisdom. Verse 22 says, professing to be wise, they became fools. So man has taken God's revelation, he's exchanged it for human wisdom. And that's the whole theory of creation without a God, isn't it? Man's taken God's revelation, he set it aside for human wisdom. But there's a problem with human wisdom. Man's intellect is fallen. His foolish heart is darkened. So he can't come up with the right answer apart from revelation. That's why God gives revelation. God provides creation to reveal his attributes. What does man do? He worships creation. And all the philosophers, all the thinkers of the Greek-Roman Empire didn't change that. They worship creation. That's verse 23. Now, the most brilliant thinker in the world, and we kind of tend to deify intellect in our culture, don't we? We kind of tend to put scientists on a pedestal and say, these guys are going to solve the problems of the world. But you know what? Look at Isaiah 55. In Isaiah 55, we see why the most brilliant thinker in the world is a fool without revelation. Isaiah 55, and you probably all heard this, starting at verse 8, it says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So man, without revelation, and it doesn't say in verse 8, "My thoughts are not your thoughts," unless you have an IQ of over 150. It doesn't say that. It says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts." It doesn't matter who you are. The most brilliant thinker in the world is a fool without revelation because God's thoughts are different. It says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord." So, you know, as much as we tend to put scientists on a pedestal, they really don't have it all together unless they accept God's revelation for what it is, truth. Now, again, I like movies. Most of you know that. There was an old science fiction movie in the 1950s that some of you may have seen. It was called The Day the Earth Stood Still. Michael Rennie was in it. And, he came in a spaceship and said, "You found atomic power. Now you're a danger to the universe. So either you have to all agree to be good guys or we're going to blow up your little planet." That's kind of basically the plot. So who do they get together? The governments wouldn't even talk to the guy, so they called on the scientist. Because the scientist was going to save the world. And you know what? You see that same plot throughout the science fiction movies in the 1950s over and over again. The bad guys are coming, and the scientists are going to save the world. And we kind of tend to deify this intelligence, this science. My question is this: if you exchange God's revelation for human wisdom, and you know what? Most churches you go to have done just that. And you go to church, and what do they talk about? They'll talk about the things they think are the issues of the day. You know, not man's attitude towards revelation. They'll talk about things like abortion and our society and welfare and all this and that. My question is, why on earth would you want to waste a good Sunday morning? And it's very nice out this morning. Why would you want to waste a morning like this to come and hear what a person has to think? I wouldn't. If you come to hear what I have to think, I apologize. Because, you know, all I can do is report what God has to say. And that's revelation. And that's the issue. Our attitude towards revelation. And Romans 1 says that man's attitude towards revelation, and we'll see this throughout this whole section, is to ignore it, to hold it down. So where do you go from there? If you ignore God's revelation, where do you go from there? Human religion. So man exchanges revelation for human wisdom and human religion. Verse 23, and exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, and of birds, four-footed animals, and crawling creatures. So, religion is a direct result of departure from God's truth. If you get away from God's truth, you'll go directly to religion, so to speak. That's where it leads. Religion, remember, and I'm using that word in a very bad sense. Religion, in the sense I'm using, is man trying to win favor with God. And that's always been how man has attempted religion. He'll do all kinds of things to win favor from God. Remember that they used to throw babies into frying pans, basically, and kill them. They called it making them walk through the fire. Why'd they do that? Because they hated kids? No, it's because they were trying to appease an angry God. They're trying to win favor with God. And that's what always results when we exchange God's truth for religion. First, the worship of God is replaced by the worship of man. Look at Daniel chapter 3. Romans 1:23 says, and exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man. Look at Daniel chapter 3. That's a perfect example of that. Nebuchadnezzar. It says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, and he set it upon the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all their rulers of the province to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. So he set up an image of himself. The image of the incorruptible God has been exchanged, or the glory of an incorruptible God, for an image in the form of corruptible man. So man has exchanged revelation for human wisdom, for human religion. Worship of God then is replaced with worship of man. Remember in the Roman Empire, the emperors claimed deity. They were God on earth. That follows throughout religion. In fact, look at 2 Thessalonians 2. It's not done yet. Remember who else is going to claim to be deity and force people to worship him? Satan. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3, and talking about the, remember, the Thessalonians thought they were in the day of the Lord, and Paul is correcting that mistaken idea. And in doing so, in verse 3, he says, "Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come," or "it's not present," would be a better translation, "unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction." And he's talking about the person we generally call the Antichrist there. And verse 4 tells what this guy does. It says, "Who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God." So this man claiming deity thing is not over yet. There's more to come. That's human religion. That's what people have exchanged God's truth for. Then back to Romans 1. Not only does man then worship man, he worships animals. He says, "Exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures." And that was very common. You know, deities in human form were what the Greeks worshipped. Deities in animal form were what the Egyptians... Remember, the Egyptians' gods had animal heads. Anubis was the jackal god, remember? And they had the gods related to animals. The Chaldeans worshipped reptiles. It's a very common theme in religion. But Rome had both. It had worship of men and animals. So they were very cosmopolitan. The ones Paul was writing to, they worshipped anything, you know, man or animal. You know, this is so... I don't know, it just seems so relevant. Hey, how can I make the Bible relevant for today? I don't have to. It's perfectly relevant. And I won't say that the animal rights movement actually worships animals, but I could see it coming to that. I mean, we kind of starting to think in those directions. You know, some of the more militant animal rights people would say, if you saw a dog and a boy drowning, you should save the dog. You know, we're kind of going that way. So man is exchanged. Now, we'll pick up next time with verse 24 and see what the result of that was. Notice verse 24 starts with a therefore, and we'll pick it up there next week. Father, thank you again for your word, which is living and powerful. Thank you for the book of Romans. We pray again that we can be accurate in our interpretation of this book, and we pray that we can be diligent in believing what God has to say to us. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.